You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
At the beginning of the Broadway revival of Eugene Ionesco's Exit the King, we are told that King Berenger, a ruler whose foolish policies and ill-advised wars have brought his nation to the brink of ruin, will die at the end of the play. Although we know what's coming, as portrayed by Geoffrey Rush, the death becomes a wildly entertaining tour de force. It's currently on stage at the Ethel Barrymore Theater with a glittering cast that includes Susan Sarandon, Lauren Ambrose, and Andrea Martin, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Geoffrey Rush, the Academy Award-winning actor, to our show today. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
In addition to starring in this play, you're also the co-translator, along with the director Neil Armfield. When did you begin working on this project?
Well, officially, only in 2006.
In Australia?
Yeah. We initially did a season in Melbourne and then in Sydney. Unfortunately, an expatriate Australian theatre producer who works here on Broadway, Stuart Thompson, came to see it in the Sydney season and said, I think you guys should bring this to Broadway. And we went, Ionesco on Broadway, that sounds like a challenge.
Well, we've had him. We've had other plays. In fact, The Chairs,
yeah,
was,
The Chairs
was produced a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it was fine. But this play hasn't been seen in New York in a long time. And considering the wonderful reviews and the great audience response, why do you think it isn't performed more?
I call it a forgotten masterpiece. I think it is a, if it's not the greatest play in the world, it's certainly a fantastic recipe for brilliant theater making. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think it may have been tainted with the idea of it becoming an academic tool, because the ideas in the play are so rich in terms of its political argument, its existential poetry, its burlesque, its philosophies, its the kind of wisdom and the unusualness of his syntax and stuff.
Well, to some degree, it's almost the sort of thing that we expect from Beckett. Waiting for Godot kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we love Beckett.
Yeah.
Well, another Waiting for Godot on Broadway.
Indeed.
Another one.
I know. It's a thrilling season to be a part of, to think that. And God of Carnage by Yasmina Reza.
Which we will be talking about in a little while.
Mm.
So when did you first read this thing? And when you read it, did you recognize that this might be something that would be really good for you?
I think I read in Alec Guinness's, one of his diaries maybe, he mentioned that he'd been in the Royal Court production back in the early 60s, first English language production, I believe. And I've always thought he was a pretty interesting chooser of parts. So I thought, I'm going to check this play out. I've never heard of it. You know, I've heard of Rhinoceros, The Bald Soprano, and The Lesson. They're in the theatrical repertoires of repertory companies around the world. So I read the play and was, you know, right from page one, was absolutely blown away by this bold theatrical style of parading the characters, and then just as the king is falling over 15 times in a row, unable to get up.
And is that in the script, all the physical comedy?
Yeah, Ionesco says the king falls, and, you know, he gets up, and they say, long live the king. The king falls again, and I thought, ooh, this is quite interesting.
Even at the end of
the page, he says, this must all be played in a grand guignol style. He kind of gives you a few little pithy stage directions. He also throws in stage directions like, by theatrical magic, Queen Marie disappears. Do you know what I mean? Quite a challenge. Or the king's hair suddenly turns white.
And you do that.
But we managed to find a way of doing it.
I'm not sure I want to ask you to reveal the secret, but it's quite an extraordinary moment.
Yes, my son saw the play four times before he actually saw the technique of it. But that's part of the fun that I think Ionesco likes to have with his world in the theatre.
And why did you decide to do a new translation?
There was an existing translation from the first productions in the early 60s, which we felt had not dated, but it just had lost a certain immediacy. You know, I think within a generation or two, certain phrases of slang or certain ease of language becomes, you know, it's like if you listen to radio broadcasts now from the early 60s, people spoke funny. Do you know what I mean? Sure. Fashions change. And
They change when they come from Australia to the United States. So
we had to modify certain things because we had flavoured in certain easy bits of Australian idiom that Americans would say, well, I don't know what you mean by that. What is to wag school? We don't know what it means.
I don't know what to wag school is.
Playing truant, yeah.
You worked on this with Neil Armfield, and you've collaborated on a number of earlier projects with him. Do you tend to agree on the general approach?
We're neither of us are really writers, but as a sort of joint sense of a theatrical partnership, we both sort of feel as though we land ideas on the same page.
Now, I don't know whether this happened in Australia, but in this country, people will see parallels between King Berenger's reign and the end of the Bush administration. Was that in your mind?
There was a certain zeitgeist, I suppose. Ian Esko, I believe, wrote this play. He wrote it in 1962, in April.
He'd never heard of Barack Obama at that point.
No, it was certainly not. But they were at the height of the Cold War, and I think that's deeply structured inside the play, this feeling of humankind has reached a point of total annihilation. And the idea of those two strands of thought that go through the play of the king's death as a human being and the death of the state of his kingdom are the two key ideas that Ian Esko's playing with. And I would have thought that even with a retrospective sense of that, that the play would still work. But when we decided to do it in 2007... certainly in the English-speaking Western world, we were coming to the end of 10 years of Blair's rule, and it was a tired government. We were at the end of an 11-year rule by the conservative Howard government in Australia, and the end of two terms of the Bush administration. So the ideas in the play were very, very immediate in terms of leadership gone off the rails. But at the same time, we didn't want the play... You would diminish the universality of the play if you made it purely a topical reference, because in our initial rehearsals, we talked as much about Louis the XIV and Ceausescu and some Tongan leaders. We saw photos of you know, British monarchy descendants in Tonga wearing the same grand imperial robes of the George the Fifth era now. And the madness of that, I mean, wearing those very long trains is great for clowning with, because it's pomp.
Well, although it is about someone who's dying, this is a very funny play. And you suggest that it's in the Ian Esko original, because it just felt like it was so much fun to play that some of this must have just come out of performing it now.
Yes, there are. Look, it's 99.5% a direct translation from Ian Esko, with a certain spin on the texture and the flavour of the language.
Because you made it fairly contemporary.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the original existing English translation, they use the word ought. One ought not to do it. I thought people don't use ought has gone. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's beyond. But there are a couple of moments that I would like to think certainly Ian Esko in flavor.
Well, the king may be something of a clown, but he's also a tragic figure. And despite his many faults, it's important, I would assume, for you to get audiences to feel a certain sympathy for him.
It's the great challenge is that if he is truly despotic, and you have to lean on that side, that he's irascible and he's a megalomaniac, and the ramifications of what he's allowed to happen to the kingdom that he's presumably in charge of is despicable. But I can almost feel, I can't actually locate the precise point, but in the audience, 1,000 people feel like a group at the beginning watching a story unfold. And by the end, when they go on this quite remarkable journey with Susan's character, the elder queen, I can almost sense 1,000 individuals sitting out there with a deeply personal connection to what's happening on the stage. And that's great to to play off.
And we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the two queens, played by Susan Sarandon and Lauren Ambrose, rather brilliantly. My guest is Jeffrey Rush. We are talking about Exit the King, which is currently at the Ethel Barrymore Theater. And also in the cast is Andrea Martin, another wonderful comic actress. Stay with us for more. We're back with Jeffrey Rush. He is starring in a production of Eugene Ionesco's Exit the King, which he has also co-translated with his longtime collaborator, the director Neil Armfield. And also in the cast are Susan Sarandon and Lauren Ambrose, who play his two wives, the two queens. It's not as happy a situation as that might suggest.
No. I keep forgetting how audacious that premise is to the, out of the six characters in the play, who are presumably the only six people left in this kingdom that's completely fallen apart, that he actually has two wives.
And nothing is made of it.
No. It's
a given fact.
She's live-in, the older wife is live-in, and has to cope with the fact that he's taken a, you know, a rather feisty and sexy younger trophy wife. And then the only comment Ionesco makes on it is that this argument erupts at one point out of nowhere, where the older queen suddenly turns on him and says, "You slaughtered my mother and my father and my cousins and your own brothers." And you just think this guy is like either a medieval butcher or some kind of, you know, contemporary despot. But he doesn't, Ionesco won't give it to you in easy kind of bite-sized, you know, traditional expositional chunks.
Susan Sarandon was a big surprise for me because I know she's a wonderful film actress, but that doesn't always translate to the stage. Did you know that she was going to be this good? Because I understand you recruited her, didn't you?
Yes, I wrote her. I don't know if she might still have a copy of it. I wrote her a begging letter. No, I knew it needed a. I knew the role needed a great actor, and it needed to be somebody who could also not only bring a certain quality of diva to the stage, but you knew at the end that they had this challenge of bringing a very pure humanity and simplicity and honesty to it without any theatrical fireworks. And I thought she was going to be a really wonderful fit for that. And the other thing that was her response to the play when she read it was so visceral. She said, "Oh, I get this play. She's a bitch in the first half and she comes good at the end, and I love the politics of it and I love the meaning and the meat of it, and I need a challenge," because she said, "My kids are now at high school and I don't have to go to Little League anymore, and I want to put myself," as she said, in a out of her comfort zone. And I thought, wow, this is a great energy to bring to a production, and it'll be very exciting to work with that.
Because your comfort zone is theater, isn't it? Even though Americans know you from the films you've appeared in, you've done quite a bit of theater.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent proportionately much more time in the theater, decades in the theater, and only 10 years or so in film.
Now, this is not Lauren Ambrose's only touch with death, because Americans know her mostly from 8 Feet Under.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Six, she was
6 Feet
shallower
under.
Than that.
Yeah. I'm trying to give it more profundity. Did you also go after her, or is this just a lucky bit of chance?
No, I'd seen, I don't watch a lot of TV, but I'd seen 6 Feet Under, some episodes of that. And when the casting director was initially bandying around some names, I went, "Is that the redhead woman who's on 6 Feet Under?" Because she's one of those actors that just popped out of the television screen as being, highly distinctive and highly original.
Has she done a lot of theater?
She was in a very revered production, I think, of Awaken Sing,
mm-hmm.
that I think
I saw that.
Bartlett Sher directed, was it a couple of years back at the Belasco. And she did a much lauded, I keep meeting all of her leading men. She's done a Juliet and an Ophelia, I think, which is, they're the, for an actress of her age, they're the two great roles to have been.
From the beginning, at regular intervals, Queen Marguerite reminds the king that he'll die by the end of the play.
I know,
play.
It's one of the greatest spoilers.
Yeah, it takes all the suspense out, but on another level, we all know we're going to die. The real thing here is that the king is 400 years old and he doesn't feel ready to die. No matter how old we are, I guess we're not ready to go. And he does everything possible to forestall his death. Then he accepts it and even welcomes it at a certain point.
He starts out with such an arrogance. And I know it comes long before some of the more pop cultural books about the stages of dying, you know, have been published. Ionesco gets it so right in terms of taking that. That's the only, I suppose, the only narrative arc that he gives you, is that people go through denial and sadness and anger and resistance and, you know. But he makes extraordinary theatrical mileage out of that.
And the king is in really good shape for his age, at least at the start. Part of the performance is you show him go through his decline. This is an incredibly physical performance. Did you have to train for it?
I did. The basis of my training was at the Jacques Lecoq School, which is a theater school in Paris, which covers everything from acrobatics to mime to pantomime to commedia and clowning, etc., etc. So that kind of probably also drew me towards wanting to do this kind of play, and that this kind of play could take that sort of exploration. People say, "Oh, you must do Pilates for an hour before that." I go, no, because I wear a very, very heavy ermine cape. By the time I need to fall over on stage, I'm already wringing wet underneath. It's like a hot yoga workout or something.
But then you really fall, and there is nothing to cushion the fall.
No. Well, and yes, they're onto concrete tiles. But no, I do. Of course, I have very discreet areas of padding, and you got 8 shows a week. You have to do that.
Is this your first time on Broadway?
It is.
Wow, after all these years, and I would have understood when you were just an Australian star, but yes. By this time, Americans have known you for quite a while, ever since Shine.
Yeah, well, it's a thrilling season to be a part of, because whether it's coincidence or whether it's economic downturn or whatever, it's just such a thrill to be part of a season that I think 12 straight plays have opened in the last 4 weeks or something. And they're all extraordinary, diverse.
And ensemble,
pieces of the repertoire.
A lot of ensemble productions, which is really what theater should be all about, rather than the other helicopters descending from the ceiling and things like that. But many of them are also limited runs. Is this an open-ended run?
No, this is an engagement that will take us through to the middle of June.
That's it?
Yeah. That's just scheduling and things, I think. It's like there's a film coming up for me, and I've also got to get back to my family. It's the first really extended break I've had from them because my kids are in school. But there seems to be a history here of runs that last maybe 16 to 20 weeks. And that attracts certainly a very acute and very sharp Manhattan audience who seem to be thirsting for this part of the repertoire, which is, you know, great to play to.
So our audience, this is the cliche question, but it is always interesting. Are audiences different here than they are in Australia and England?
I think they're more keyed up. I just feel there's a savviness here. And we've got the good fortune that our producers have let the front row and the back row of the theatre. They're selling those 50 seats or whatever, 80 seats for $26.90. So there's always a very hip, sharp, young audience sitting and sandwiching the front row and the back row. And they light the fuse for the rest of the house. It's really, really exciting. We did schools matinees in the Australian season on a Wednesday, and 16-year-olds used to go berserk with this play. Found it quite extraordinary.
I mentioned earlier that you've had a long stage career, 70 productions or so in Australia, including one, A Waiting for Godot, with Mel Gibson?
Yeah.
And weren't you also roommates for a while?
That was way back. We did a
winter... Did he talk about religion in those days?
No. We did a winter theater season, which was more or less, they asked the postgraduates of the National Institute, which I had never been to, but I had taught there momentarily. They invited them back to this theatre company for a couple of productions in the winter months, one of which was a revival of a classic old Australian melodrama called On Our Selection, which was about a rural family, very burlesque, very, you know, sentimental, kind of fun. It had been very popular as a radio serial back in the 40s and 50s. And the company was involved in that, and then five members of that company also played in Waiting for Godot. And Mel was 23 at the time, I was 28. We were way too young, but I think we were pretty hilarious. I mean, I'd just come back from the Lecoq School in Paris, so I was very keen to find the dimensions of the vaudevillian clowning that's so much a part of that play.
I'm assuming that your life changed totally with Shine. Did it mean you suddenly started getting a lot of film offers outside of Australia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, the way Shine traveled to certainly the English-speaking world had a direct influence on being offered roles in Shakespeare in Love and Elizabeth, etc.
And
though, mind you, at the time...
Also Pirates of the Caribbean, which probably is where how younger filmgoers know you.
Yes.
And you've played a lot of ambiguous historic characters, Marquis de Sade in Quills. You played Leon Trotsky in Frida. You played Peter Sellers in a biopic. Is it more difficult to play real-life characters like them, people who we might...
It's such a strange... I mean, I, when you say that list now, I think, oh, it was never a conscious thing to play historical figures.
And also odd history. I mean, these are not...
Yes.
We're not talking about Abraham Lincoln.
No. But there's a variable on every one because, for example, in playing David Helfgott in Shine, he was certainly, it's based on a real person, but a person that was only known to in an audience's imaginations to a very narrow demographic of music lovers in Australia. So I thought, well, I still have to honour him as a person because it's very, you know, close to the bone in terms of a revelation about his character. And Peter Sellers, on the other hand, everyone's seen Peter Sellers' movies, so you've got to try and attain a certain, you know, authenticity on that.
Without becoming an impersonator.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in that particular role, I thought, I said to the director, if we can get the bits really good when we're showing the extracts from his films or things about him working on the films, I said that gives us the license then to create a character off-screen in a way that the audience may or may not know about, you know. But it all comes down, I think, to a certain level of artistic truthfulness or whatever.
Is it more difficult to maintain a film career when you live in Melbourne and not in New York or in Los Angeles?
My wife and I talked about, you know, a possible move at one point, but then we thought, well, if we moved... I mean, I'd love to live in New York City because I love it here so much. But I thought if we moved here, a film in London is still a seven-hour commute, or I still wanted to do films in Australia, so that would mean it's a 22-hour commute. Melbourne has been home base, and it's been a good, strong home base,
and the
travel is just part
of
the deal, yeah.
It's often where your kids are going to school.
And they're already established, and we certainly wanted them to have an Australian childhood.
So what's your next film? You said in June you have another project?
That's not 100% certainty, but the most recent thing I filmed was... I had an interesting year last year. I did a Korean Western, which is hopefully going to be released in the latter part of this year. And I did a film version of a very celebrated piece of Aboriginal musical theatre from Australia, which was like a huge hit in the early 90s called Brand New Day. And one of our Indigenous filmmakers has made this musical film, which is, I think, going to really make its mark.
Meanwhile, you can see Geoffrey Rush along with Susan Sarandon Lauren Ambrose, Andrea Martin, and I've forgotten the name of the other two cast members.
Bill Sadler and Brian Hutchinson.
And it's at the Ethel Barrymore Theater, and it's running through June. Major success, Eugene Ionesco's Exit the King. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, Jeff Daniels and Marcia Gay Harden discuss playing parents who meet to work out how to handle a fight between their sons and end up fighting themselves in the new play, God of Carnage. By the way, you can come and hear a modern reimagining of the H.G. Wells classic, The Invisible Man, starring Peter Garrity, with music performed by Michael Riesman, director of the Philip Glass Ensemble, this Wednesday in WNYC's Green Space. You can purchase tickets at WNYC.org/thegreenspace, but do it now. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.